From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I mean, those Mexican workers who crossed the border to get into California, that is, to get into the territory that was taken from Mexico in the Mexican War, you see. And those Mexican workers who come over, and many of them die and are killed in the process, you see, those people are not alien to me. You see, those 20 million Americans who are not citizens, but who now, because of the Patriot Act, are subject to indefinite detention without any constitutional rights, those people are not alien to me. But those men in the White House who are making these decisions to send young people to kill and be killed, those people are alien to me.
Today, historian Howard Zinn. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, this Indigenous Peoples Day special, as groups across the country are holding anti-Columbus Day protests. In Denver, people are planning to gather at the state capitol to protest what they describe as the Colombian legacy of war, racism, intolerance, and violence. In Hawaii, Indigenous Peoples Day and Anti-Discoverers Day events have been organized, and other anti-Columbus Day events are scheduled throughout the country. For many people, the true story behind Christopher Columbus would not be known if it were not for historian Howard Zinn, who chronicled Columbus' so-called discovery of the Americas in his People's History of the United States. Zinn attempts to tell the story of Columbus through the eyes of people who were here when he arrived, where the people Columbus called Indians because he thought he was in India. And he relied heavily on primary documents and Columbus's own writing that put Columbus in a far different light than many history textbooks. Zinn quotes one letter from Columbus that reads, quote, "They would make fine servants with 50 men. We could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want." In another journal entry, Columbus wrote, "From here, one might send, in the name of Holy Trinity, as many slaves as could be sold." Well, today we're going to hear a recent speech of Howard Zinn, author of People's History of the United States, on the USA Patriot Act, on immigration, on war and empire. This is Howard Zinn.
I have great confidence that the truth is beginning to come through to more and more people. This is how change takes place. And, you know, this is how it's a tribute. It's a tribute to the common sense and common decency of the American people that the establishment has to work so hard to keep the truth from us, you see. They, you know, and I really believe that when people learn what is going on, they respond. And we've seen this historically. We've seen this again and again. Now, when the abolitionists, the first abolitionists, the first people in the North who spoke out against slavery in the 1830s began to talk about slavery, they were mobbed and they were attacked, not in the South, all over the North, you know. The truth that they spoke began to seep through to the American public, the truth about slavery. You know, a man named Theodore Weld wrote a book, Slavery as It Is. And the book, although ignored by the powers that be, was read and read and read, you say. And by the time of the early 1960s, the anti-slavery movement had gone from a tiny handful of people to an enormous national movement. That's why we had an Emancipation Proclamation. That's why we had a 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. Not because Abraham Lincoln was elected president, although it wasn't bad, you see. But the key was that when Abraham Lincoln was elected president, this great anti-slavery movement was rising in the country. And we've seen this again and again. We've seen it in recent years when people learn the truth. Racial segregation in the South was really not in the consciousness of the American people. Remember Ralph Ellison's book, Invisible Man? That was true. Black people were invisible, and the condition of black people was invisible. Of course, not to black people, but certainly to the white population of the country. What happened in the 1960s is that black people, seeing that the American government was not going to help them, knowing that the American government, oh, not just the South, but the national government, the government of the United States, had collaborated with the South to maintain racial segregation all through history, black people in the South knew that they had to do it themselves. They had to bring democracy alive themselves. They had to bring the truth to the American people. And so they went out into the streets and they sat in and they went on freedom rides and they demonstrated and they created a commotion in the country which could not be ignored. And people began to learn the truth about what was happening in the South, the truth what was happening to black people in the South. And then you finally had a national movement that, whether you had a Republican or a Democrat in the House or if Congress or in the presidency, it didn't matter. You had a national movement where finally the government had to respond, and you began to see a remarkable change in the South and in the consciousness of the country about racial equality. That's what social movements do. They bring the truth to people, and people, when they learn what is going on, respond. This is what happened during the war in Vietnam. People did not know what was going on in Vietnam. All they knew what was being told to them by the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, and, oh, they fired on our ships in the Gulf of Tonkin. I mean, who knew where the Gulf of Tonkin was? Maybe it was off the coast of San Francisco, you see. Nobody knew, really. Did the president know? Well, he was briefed. Presidents get briefed. That's how they know about things. People didn't know what was going on. Yeah. And how did they learn? They didn't learn through the major media. They learned through the 1960s equivalents of Democracy Now. They learned through Noam. They learned through books. They learned through independent media like Dispatch News Service, a little group of left a journalist who went into Asia, and they were the first ones to break the story of the My Lai massacre to the American public. And when American people began to see what was happening in Vietnam, when finally the pictures began to appear, when finally they saw the huts being burned and the peasants cowering before American power, they began to react to this. And soon we had a national movement against the war. And the war in Vietnam did not end because Henry Kissinger went to Paris. The war in Vietnam did not end because of anything Congress or the President or the Supreme Court did. The war in Vietnam ended because of the people in Vietnam who resisted and because the people in the United States who finally began to resist the government and because of the... The GIs, you know, David, you heard David sing about the San Patricio Battalion of the American GIs who looked around in the Mexican War and saw what was going on and went over to the other side. And in the Vietnam War, it was American GIs who played a very critical role in bringing the war to an end when they refused to go out on patrol and when they turned against the war. And when they came back, when the GIs came back from Vietnam and they formed an organization, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. We've never seen anything like it in the history of this country. You know, and they gathered... And some of you may remember that scene where they gathered in Washington, these GIs who had come back from the war, and some of them in wheelchairs or with arms missing, and hurled their medals over a fence into a heap to demonstrate their opposition to the war. The truth began to come out, and the truth had an effect. And I believe that is what is going on today, just the beginning of the truth coming out to the American public of what is going on in Iraq and in the world. Beginning to learn the truth that we are not liberating Iraq, we are occupying Iraq. And during World War II, that expression became well known, Nazi-occupied Europe, Nazi-occupied France. And then after World War II, we talked about the Soviets occupying Hungary and the Soviets occupying Czechoslovakia, you see. And now it's the United States occupying Iraq. And the news is beginning to filter through. I mean, the major media tried their best to bury the news in back pages and to cover it up with all sorts of things, but the news beginning to come through. This is a very ruthless occupation which is taking place in Iraq. They saw, the other day you may have seen this news story about how the U.S. General Sanchez in Baghdad, was worried about Iraqi reaction to the occupation. The Iraqi leaders, the ones who were pro-America, were giving him a message, as he put it, quote, "When you take a father in front of his family and put a bag over his head and put him on the ground, you have had a significant adverse effect on his dignity and respect in the eyes of his family." I thought that was very sensitive and perceptive. Amnesty International has been looking into cases of torture in Iraq and beginning to report, case of Raisan al-Abali. His house is invaded by American soldiers. They come in shooting, and they arrest him and his 80-year-old father. His brother is wounded. The three men are taken away, and Khraisan tells Amnesty International later that his American interrogators stripped him naked, kept him awake for more than a week, either standing or on his knees, bound hand and foot with a bag over his head. He said he told his captors, "I don't know what you want. I don't know what you want. I have nothing. I asked them to kill me," says Khraisan. After 8 days, they let him and his father go. U.S. officials did not respond to repeated requests to discuss the case. Paul Bremer, the U.S. administrator of Iraq, said, "We are, in fact, carrying out our international obligations." Yes, international obligations, except to the U.N., except to the world. Who is this? To whom? And the soldiers who have to do that, the soldiers are set down in a country which is hostile to them. They become afraid. They become panicky. They become trigger happy. They react with the brutality that fearful soldiers or fearful policemen show when they themselves are afraid. And they're beginning to recognize, and we're hearing the stories about the soldiers who are asking, why are we here? What are we doing here? And an ABC news reporter in Iraq tells me of a soldier who tells him, "I've got my own most wanted list." He was referring to the deck of cards. You remember reading the deck of cards the U.S. government published, in which they featured Saddam Hussein and his sons and other wanted members of the former Iraqi regime. And the soldier said, I have my own deck of cards. The aces in my deck are Paul Bremer, Donald Rumsfeld, George Bush, and Paul Wolfowitz. I think there's something more ominous about than the occupation of Iraq, and that is the occupation of the United States. I don't know if you have the same feeling I do. You wake up in the morning, you read the paper, and you feel that you are in an occupied country, you see. That you feel some alien group has taken over our country. Those Mexican workers who crossed the border to get into California, that is to get into the territory that was taken from Mexico in the Mexican War, you see. And those Mexican workers who come over, and many of them die and are killed in the process, you see. Those people are not alien to me, you see. Those 20 million Americans who are not citizens, but who now, because of the Patriot Act, are subject to indefinite detention without any constitutional rights, those people are not alien to me. But those men in the White House who are making these decisions to send young people to kill and be killed, those people are alien to me. I mean, the country's in the hands of men who care nothing about human life, care nothing about human freedom, care nothing about the earth, the water, the sun, care nothing about the kind of world that our children and grandchildren are going to inherit. And I believe that Americans are more and more, beginning to sense this. The lies are being exposed, and, those the weapons of mass destruction, it's become absurd, right? What were called the drones of death turn out to be model airplanes. The decontamination trucks turn out to be fire trucks, mobile germ labs turn out to be trailers making balloons, you see. And so, lies about self-determination. Talk about self-determination, and we fly these wealthy Iraqi exiles into Baghdad to take over, just as we flew a ZM into Vietnam back then, and we were for the self-determination of the Vietnamese. We had flown them in from New Jersey, say, and then there is a larger lie, that everything that the United States government does here and in the world needs to be done because we are engaged in a war on terrorism, ignoring the fact that war is terrorism, and ignoring the fact that, barging into people's homes, taking away family members, subjecting them to torture, that is terrorism. Invading and bombing other countries does not give us more security against terrorism. It makes us less secure. It makes us more vulnerable. You can get a clue to what the government means by the war on terrorism. If you examine what a Secretary of Defense, if you have the stomach for examining anything said by the Secretary of Defense, but examine what Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, one of those faces on that sergeant's most wanted list, Rumsfeld said about a year ago. He was addressing the NATO summit in Brussels, and he was explaining the threats to the West. Imagine we're still talking of the West as if it were a holy entity, as if the United States has not alienated most of the Western world and is now wooing Eastern countries and trying to persuade non-Western countries that we want only to liberate them. So Rumsfeld is explaining the threats to the West and why they are invisible and unidentifiable. And he says, I'm quoting him now because I could not make this up. There are things that we know And there are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things we now know that we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. These are things we do not know we do not know. He goes on to say, simply because you do not have evidence that something exists doesn't mean that you have evidence that it doesn't exist. Well, Rumsfeld has clarified things for us.
Historian Howard Zinn, speaking in Provincetown, Cape Town, Massachusetts, in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, this August. We're going to come back to the speech in just a minute here on Democracy Now! Yay boy, Africando here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we return to Howard Zinn, author of People's History of the United States, talking about Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld.
He's explained why the government, not really knowing where to find the criminals of September 11th, we'll just go ahead and invade and bomb Afghanistan, killing thousands of people and driving hundreds of thousands of people from their homes and still not know where the criminals are, you see. It explains why the government, not really knowing what weapons Saddam Hussein is hiding or if he's hiding any weapons, will invade and bomb Iraq to the horror of the world, killing thousands of civilians and thousands of soldiers and terrorizing the population. And explains why the government, not knowing who are terrorists and who are not, will put hundreds of people in confinement in Guantanamo and subject them to torture and indefinite detention to the point where suicides have been attempted again and again by the prisoners in Guantanamo. And explains why the government, not knowing who the terrorists are, will put these 20 million people who are not citizens under the jurisdiction of the Patriot Act, depriving them of all their constitutional rights, making them subject momentarily to any kind of invasion of their homes, picking them up, taking them away, and nobody knowing, you know, where they are. So the war on terrorism is not just a war on innocent people in other countries. It's a war on the people of the United States. It's a war on our liberties. It's a war on our standard of living. The wealth of the country is being stolen from the people. Remember what Eisenhower said in that strangely good moment that Eisenhower had when he said that every weapon that is made is a theft from the needs of the American people. The wealth of the American people, the wealth of the people is being stolen from the citizens of the United States, from the people in this country, and handed over to the super rich, and the lives of the young are being stolen. And I believe this is becoming more and more clear to more people in this country. Even the polls, distorted as they are, and they are, you know, even they show declining support for Bush. And I don't know if any of you noticed this, but it's my job to notice these things. It's my job, painful as it is, to read Thomas Friedman, you see. And there was this column that he wrote just after the war began, in which he said, I'm quoting Thomas Friedman, "Don't believe the polls. I've been to nearly 20 states recently, and I found that 95% of the country wants to see Iraq dealt with without a war." This is Friedman, who's for the war, totally, then, now. He also said in his column that his wife opposed the war. She was one of the 95%, you see. It's been interesting to me and important to me because sort of in just from reading American history and from living in the South and being involved in the movement there, to me, I've always thought that you just could learn so much about the country by looking at the history of black people and looking at the attitudes of black people. And all through this period, while the polls were showing majorities in support for Bush, the polls were showing 60% of black people were opposed to the war all the way through. And I had this experience doing a phone interview with a radio station in Washington, D.C., a black radio station called GW on the Hill. GW stands for George Wilson, the guy who's the interviewer on the station. Actually, it was hard for me to say much because all of his questions were rhetorical questions. Like, don't you think that we are in the grip of madness? Not much to say, you see. But after he sort of did this interview with me, there were call-ins. And I took notes, because nobody could see me. I'm home on the telephone. I could secretly take notes on these call-ins. There were 8 call-ins, and all of them clearly African-Americans. And I'm reading from my notes. John, this was right after Colin Powell had given his speech to the UN about weapons of mass destruction. John, what Powell said was political garbage. Another caller, Powell was just playing a game. That's what happens when people get into high office. Robert, if we go to war, innocent people will die for no good reason. Karine, what Powell said was hogwash. War will not be good for this country. Susan, what is so good about being a powerful country? Terry, it's all about oil. Another caller, the last of the 8 callers. The U.S. is in search of an empire, and it will fall, as the Romans did. Remember when Ali fought Foreman? He seemed asleep, but when he woke up, he was ferocious. So will the people wake up. I believe it will become more and more clear that the casualties of war are not just abroad, you know, but here at home. You know, and very often it is said that, you know, that it would be hard to build a movement against the war because we don't have the huge casualties that we had in Vietnam. On the other hand, we have a communication system which, despite the monopolization of the media, has moved faster and more efficiently than any communication system during the Vietnam War. Through Democracy Now!, through the community radio, through the internet. And that's why we had those enormous demonstrations against the war, even before the war had started. But I want to say something about casualties, battle casualties. In the Spanish-American War, I always like to go back 100 years, 200 years. In the Spanish-American War, the United States, it was one of those short wars, which we have now become accustomed to. It was called a splendid little war by a member of the cabinet. There were only a few hundred American battle casualties. There were 5,000 soldiers who were in Cuba who died, not battle casualties. They died of poisoned beef sold to the army by the meatpackers of Swift and Armour in Chicago. Every war has its battle casualties and it has its other casualties. What happens to the soldiers who don't die in battle but who die for other reasons? What happened not to the soldiers of Vietnam who died on the battlefield, but what happened to the soldiers afterward? What did they suffer as a result of Agent Orange? How many of the kids were born deformed because of the chemicals that the United States dropped in Vietnam? How many of them began to have psychological problems? How many Vietnam veterans committed suicide in the years? Thousands and thousands of Vietnam veterans committed suicide after the war in Vietnam. And the Gulf War, you know, here too, oh, we've only had a couple of hundred American casualties. The VA, 10 years after the Gulf War, reported that 8,000 veterans of the Gulf War were dead for various reasons. That of the 600,000 soldiers who fought in the Gulf War, 200,000 of them after the Gulf War filed claims with the Veterans Administration for disabilities that they had suffered during the war as a result of the weaponry that the United States was using in the war. The weapons that we use against other people are also used against us. A government that is ruthless about what it does to other people is also ruthless in what it does, you know, to our own people. So what is our job, you know? As Noam said, there's nothing magical, no secrets. I have the same experience he does. People want to know, what is the secret? There's no secret is people. The secret is people getting together. The secret is telling the truth. The truth is powerful, and it can only be suppressed for so long. And the truth gets out, and when the truth gets out, a power is created that is greater than the power of the guns and money that a government possesses, you see. And, I mean, why is it that people all over the world knew things, knew the truth about the American impending war in Iraq, and 10 million of them protested on one day, February 15th. Why is it that they knew the truth when the American people still did not? I mean, to me, there's a simple answer. The people in those other countries did not watch Fox News, let's say. So our job, yes, is to tell the truth. And we all can do that. You don't have to be a speaker with a microphone. You don't have to sell hundreds of thousands of books. All of us speak to other people. All of us have neighbors. All of us have people we work with. We have children. We are maybe teachers, or we may be librarians. Or whatever we do, there are people that we reach. There are ways in which we can communicate information to people and steer them towards sources of information which are different, you know, than the major media. We are all in a position, all of us in a position to do this. And we start with great support. We start with the support of the people of the world. That's great support. And we start with the support of the artists. I've always been struck by the musicians, the actors, the writers, the poets. These are the people who almost always come forward and through a special sensibility that they have, they see what is right and they see what is wrong. And so our job simply is in every possible way, in the smallest ways, in the largest ways, in the most apparently innocuous ways, or in the most bold ways, you know, from writing a letter to the editor of your local paper to doing what those three nuns in Colorado did, civil disobedience, and bringing them years in jail. But all along the spectrum, we all do, you know, what we can do in some way to spread the truth. No action too small, too large for us to engage in, and to defy what the government is trying to get us to do, to keep silent. There are already librarians, and you maybe read about it, librarians who are shredding their records because they know that the paper, you know. I mean, the truth is, I don't blame the FBI for wanting to see those records. They want to know who is reading Noam Chomsky, you see. But defying them is what more and more people do. I go around the country and I see high school students defying the principal, defying even their classmates, high school students, you see. So that's what social change is about, telling the truth, organizing, acting in every way we can. You know, we live in a beautiful country. It's been taken over, and our job is to take it back. Thank you.
Historian Howard Zinn, author of People's History of the United States, speaking in Provincetown, Cape Cod, this past August. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go north to Alaska. Stay with us. Columbus, Burning Spear, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On this Indigenous Peoples Day, we go to Alaska. On March 24, 1989, the Exxon Valdez oil tanker crashed into a reef, spewing millions of gallons of heavy crude oil into the waters of the Prince William Sound. Within days, 1,500 miles of coast were polluted, leaving a trail of dying, oil-drenched wildlife. Hundreds of thousands of birds were killed. Thousands of sea otters died alongside harbor seals, whales, and brown bears. Overnight, the livelihood of thousands of fishermen disappeared. Dune Lankard was one of them. He's an Eyak fisherman. The Eyak are an indigenous people who occupied the lands in the Copper River region in south-central Alaska for some 3,500 years. They're as much a part of the Copper River ecosystem as the bears and the salmon that inhabit it. After the Exxon Valdez spill, Lankard decided he would make it his life's mission to help prevent the kind of destruction of life and livelihood. He says, quote, "By the ocean dying, something came to life in me." He began working with the Indigenous Environmental Network and Project Underground. He later started the Red Oil Network, an organization focused on halting and providing alternatives to destructive oil and gas projects. He now sits on the board of several action-oriented nature and culture preservation organizations, including Raqqa Society, Circle of Life, Siva Foundation, to name but a few. He's the co-founder of the EAC Preservation Council and Red Zone, a group whose mission is to protect the inherent rights of culture, heritage, language, and ancestral lands of Native people in Alaska. He joins us on the phone from Alaska. Dun Lankard, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
It's very good to have you with us. Where exactly are you?
Well, I live in a small coastal fishing town called Cordova, and it's right in south central Alaska, right on the coast in the Gulf of Alaska, where it's just, we get a lot of wind and rain and snow, a lot of precipitation this time of year.
Can you talk about, well, how the Exxon Valdez oil spill changed your life and changed the life of the EAC people?
Well, it is something that happened over time that really affected our thinking, our beliefs, our values. And when I grew up fishing, all I've ever really done is fish in Prince William Sound in the Copper River Delta region of Alaska here. And we grew up, you know, believing that we would be able to pass on our heritage and our culture, our fishing way of life on to our children. And, you know, I felt that this was one of the most incredible wild places on earth that was bountiful and beautiful and just amazing and a way to create a home and a life for my family. And when the Exxon Valdez oil spill happened, all of the beliefs that I had that I would be able to one day share this rich way of life with others came to a screeching halt. Because what had happened was, like you said, you know, I felt that the ocean had died and something inside of me had come to life. And I realized that I had taken this entire way of life for granted and that I expected it to be there forever. And when that tanker hit the Bly Reef over there near Valdez and oil started spewing everywhere and the eyes of the world were then focused on Prince William Sound, I realized that my home was in jeopardy. Everything that I believed in, that I loved, that I cared for, that took care of me was gone. And so I sat down with my family and I said, we need to reevaluate everything that we know and we have to figure out how we're going to preserve what's left. And they all looked at me like, you know, what are you talking about? And I said, we have to make sacrifices. We have to stand up and fight for what we believe in if we want to have anything left. And so that's when I decided that I would become a part-time fisherman and a full-time citizen activist to preserve what we still have left here in Alaska.
And so talk about what you've done, the organizations you've set up.
Well, I started out in 1989 trying to figure out how I could form a legal defense fund to take on new development, new roads, new projects that I felt were hindering or going to affect our subsistence or commercial fishing way of life. And our original goal was me and my sister Pamela, who's a year and a half older than me, she said, why don't we, you know, try and figure out how we can protect the environment as well as restore our EAC culture and preserve that as well. And so we sat down and came up with an idea on how to, you know, focus on the clear cutting that was starting to happen by our native corporations here in Alaska. And we decided to put together a nonprofit called the EAC Preservation Council. And the first few years, I felt that it was something that would be welcomed by the fishermen and the native peoples, because we were actually trying to create an economic alternative to natural resource development. In this case, we were trying to create avenues for being paid to leave our trees standing rather than cutting them down and paying the shareholders nothing. And at the same time, by knocking the forest down, it would jeopardize our subsistence and commercial fishing way of life. And so by 1991, the Exxon Corporation had settled with the state and federal government to create the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council, and they received approximately $900 million for restoration in the Exxon spill zone. And basically what this meant was that we could then ask the money for the money to be used towards science to help the communities restore and recover from the Exxon spill. And also, we felt it was a perfect avenue to create an economic alternative to the clear-cutting that was commencing in the region. So from 1989 to 1995, over 50,000 acres of trees fell in Prince William Sound alone. Over 150,000 acres of trees fell in the Exxon spill zone from Cordova to Kodiak. And so what we asked was that at least half of the money be used for habitat protection, in this case salmon habitat, to be protected in perpetuity in the spill zone. So we advocated, we helped organize native peoples, fisher folks. We talked with conservation organizations. We did everything we possibly could to endorse habitat protection in the spill zone. And it led to the protection of over 700,000 acres of land that was scheduled to be clear-cut and paying over $400 million to native corporations to leave their trees standing and protect their subsistence way of life. And so shortly after that, you know, we started realizing that there was other things that we had interest in. And so I myself, you know, decided to get involved in the Alaska Action Center and get on the board and address other issues in other parts of the state to help other indigenous peoples and citizen activists protect their way of life and their culture. And then, you know, I met up with Julia Butterfly, and she was, you know, working to save the headwaters, the other end of the Coastal Temperate Rainforest that we live on. And so I started helping her with her Circle of Life Foundation and just trying to, again, get the word out. And then it led to me working with other organizations like the Save a Foundation and helping start the Native Movement, which addresses subsistence issues here in the state. And
Dune Lankard, can you talk about the Eyak people and talk about your culture and your history?
Yes, the Eyaks are an Athabascan tribe out of 57 Athabascan tribes in the state of Alaska, approximately. Eyak is one of the coastal Athabascan tribes. We've never numbered over 1,000 in our history. There's probably, right now, alive today, there's about 150 of us. We only have one full-blooded living speaker of our language, and it's our honorary chief, Marie Smith Jones. She's like 85 years old now. And when Marie passes away, we'll be the first fully assimilated tribe in the state of Alaska. And right now, my family is one of the last Eyak families to live in Cordova that are still part of the ocean and this incredible way of life. And we have always lived along the coast for at least the last 3,500 years, because we came out of the interior of Alaska and migrated across the ice fields down to the ocean. And then when the glaciers started receding, there was a small strip of thin green habitat that we lived along. And for the next 3,500 years, we migrated to the west, ending up in Cordova about 500 to 700 years ago, and we primarily made our living off of the wild salmon and the wild game in this region. But because of the ice fields, the area wasn't suited to for you know, the inhabitants of thousands and thousands of indigenous peoples. And so I think that's one of the reasons historically our numbers have been fairly low. And when I started the activism, Marie, our honorary chief, named me Jamatsiki, which means the little bird that screams really loud and won't shut up. And she had realized at that point that I needed to be louder than everything else, and that we had to let people know that the EACs were still here, we're still fighting for our subsistence and sovereignty and our spirituality, and we're not going anywhere soon.
We're talking to Dune Lankert, who's co-founder of the EAC Preservation Council and Red Zone, an organization whose mission is to protect the inherent rights, culture, heritage, language, and ancestral lands of Native people in Alaska. He's in Cordova, Alaska. Can you talk about the Native corporations, the lawsuits you're involved with, and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act?
In 1971, actually prior to 1971, what had happened was the state of Alaska and the federal government wanted to figure out how they were going to deal with building the Alaska pipeline across Native lands without having a settlement with the Native peoples. Because, again, as a lot of people know, in Alaska, we've never been conquered, we're not a treaty state, and we've never been outright sold. We've never agreed to the sale of our land. And so here in Alaska, they still had, the government still had a problem with Indians. And so the way that they felt that they wanted to best deal with it was rather than have reservations like they have in America where they set aside land and reserve it for Indian people called reservations, they decided to put us in corporations here. So they established 13 regional corporations that own the subsurface rights to all of our lands, which is everything below the surface, all the minerals, oil, gas, etc., and then established 226 village corporations that own the surface rights of those lands. Now, every Native person in the state at the time, there was about 65,000 of us, received 100 shares apiece. Basically, if you had a quarter Native blood or more, you were entitled to a minimum of 100 shares of your village corporation, in our case, the EAC Corporation, that bears our name, and 100 shares in our regional corporation, which is the Chugach Alaska Corporation. And the government felt that as long as we were set up in corporations, then they could go ahead and build their pipeline across Native lands without having to pay any royalties, because they didn't have to deal with sovereignty at that time, because they basically said that our Aboriginal rights were extinguished for sovereignty and subsistence. Subsistence has never been settled. That issue is ongoing, and that, too, won't go away. But the one thing that, you know, I realized from a very young age, from the time I was probably 10, because my mother, Rosie, who passed away last year, was one of the founders of the EAC Corporation and the Native Village of EAC, and she told us kids that, you know, we were the ones who would have to take over when she was gone. And she basically said that they're here to take your land, and how they're going to do it is through this corporate structure. You're going to have to learn the law. You're going to have to learn about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. You're going to have to learn about the Alaska Natural Interest Lands Conservation Act in 1980. She said you're going to have to understand how they're doing this. You're going to have to read and write and understand English. And she said, and that's how you're going to be able to defend our rights and our land. And so as I got older, I realized that the only way that I could protect Indian peoples or their rights was if I could understand how these laws were set up to be used against us. And so right after the oil spill, I found a way to file shareholder derivative actions, because every time that Natives enter the courts, they're redefining the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. They're redefining what shareholder rights are. Because what we had prior to ANCSA in 1971, what had happened was we had tribal rights, we had human rights, we had cultural rights. All of those were taken away with the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And now we're stuck with, you know, shareholder rights, so the Securities Exchange Commission regulations apply to us. There's some cases that NEPA applies to us. But we realized that early on that there was a lot of issues that were completely out of our league because most of the Native peoples in the state didn't understand the law, and they didn't understand that their lands and their rights were being taken through the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
Dune Lankard, what about the energy bill?
Well, the energy policy that's being pushed forward right now could drastically affect the way that Native corporations are treated here in Alaska, because some of the language being introduced by Campbell is basically saying that Native corporations are to be recognized as tribal entities. And this would open it up for Indian lands to energy development. And in our case, like right now, for example, our Chugach Alaska Corporation, our regional, is already building bombs in the South Pacific. They have a Lockheed and Bechtel contract that basically allows them to develop war tools that allows Native peoples to be engaged in military contracts. And so on the Copper River Delta here in Alaska, they want to build roads across the Copper River Delta, across rich wild salmon spawning habitat, so they could access oil and gas fields about 60 miles east of here on the Copper River Delta. And so what we're concerned about is that this energy policy, if it's passed the way that it's written, that Senator Campbell's Indian title of the bill would basically allow Native corporations to receive federal grants and loans to further develop Indian lands. And again, our sovereignty has always been for sale by these Native corporations because this is how they're able to get contracts and be exempt from the law. And so what we're afraid of is that this development could very well threaten our subsistence way of life that's so tied to that wild salmon. And why these Native corporations would want to do this is it's all about money, the same as Bristol Bay.
On that note, we're going to have to leave it there, Dune Lankard. And I want to thank you very much for being with us, co-founder of the EAC Preservation Council in Alaska. And that does it for this Indigenous People's Day special. Tomorrow we broadcast live from Tucson, Arizona. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus-Linen, and Nadal. Anna Nogara, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scaho, Pervez Sharma, Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks today to Uri Gallet, Angela Alston, Simba Russo, Johnny Sender, Rich Kim, Chris Zucker, Karen Nucci, Dennis Moynihan, Leah Zarella, Carmen Mitchell, Isis Phillips, Joe Mergia. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.